We present Teddy Johnson as Steve Gardner in The Wolf Far Hence, a serial thriller in six parts by Edward Boyd. Part 5, The Truth.
You get it all together, as the jargon has it nowadays. The T's crossed, the I's dotted. Everything fitting and ticking smoothly like a Swiss watch. And you lean back in satisfaction. And the armchair goes over backwards with a loud, resounding crash. Someone close to you is accused of murder. And you hear another person confront the real killer and get killed for his effrontery. So, you report it dutifully, and the police go down to collect the corpus delicti. You sit back smugly, remembering. I could hear it all again and see it all again. The strange, impassioned monologue, the mad, contrapuntal whistling, the scream, the fall, the dead, broken body. And now a policeman in a baggy, thick tweed suit was blowing my mind and telling me that it all had never happened. But that's crazy.
Something's crazy. But whether it's the story or the storyteller remains to be seen.
But I was there when it happened. I saw Ketch, lying there dead.
Then why isn't the body there now? Gardner, obstructing the police is a serious business.
The best way to obstruct them round here is to leave them to their own intelligence.
That's a warning, Gardner. Take it seriously.
You fuzz are all the same. When the crunch comes, it's all one-way traffic. Just what am I supposed to gain by feeding you a yarn like that?
You can best answer that yourself.
No, I can't, so I'm throwing it back to you.
You could be trying to confuse the issue.
And why would I want to do that?
Out of some kind of loyalty to Trudy Clark.
You don't seriously believe that.
Only if I'm being charitable.
Damn you and your charity. Save it until Ketch walks in that door and calls me a liar. You'll need all your charity then.
Why?
Because it'll be Resurrection Day.
Oh, you have a warped sense of humor.
Somebody has. All right, then. If I'm indulging in fantasies, where is Ketch?
We are looking for him.
Good luck.
I think that after last night he panicked and ran.
He wasn't running very fast last time I saw him.
Gardner, I think you should know...
They're going to arrest Judy?
Yes.
When?
Probably this afternoon.
Does she know?
She does not.
You want me to tell her, is that it?
Gardner, you are one of the few people I have ever met that could get under my skin.
Who would want to live there? All right, that's it then. You're going to stand by and let them go through with this.
I am.
Even though you think they're making a mistake?
I no longer think that they are making a mistake.
Well, you certainly fooled me.
What's much more important is that I fooled myself.
And you're still at it?
Oh, no. Oh, no. I think sometimes I have a dangerous desire to have things too tidy, and I'm not sufficiently divorced from the human race to be immune from wishful thinking.
Are you apologizing for something?
I'm simply offering an explanation. You see, I don't think I wanted Judy Clark to be guilty because I liked and respected her. Which only goes to show that a policeman must have no friends.
You won't have to worry about that in future.
And I think, too, that my professional vanity was hurt. The Tinker's murder represented a personal failure on my part. I wanted Calder's death to be caused by the same person, because that would give me a chance to redeem myself.
The chance is still there.
Oh, no, Gardner, it's not.
What makes you so certain?
Judy Clark said that she found the back door open and went out that way.
Yes?
That particular door has been locked for years. In fact, until Cunningham, the proprietor, gets back, we don't know whether there's a key in existence or not.
I see.
That's a pretty strong case, Gardner.
I don't think so. You're forgetting one little thing.
Ketch?
Ketch.
I'll go and break the bad news to Judy.
I went out and walked away from the hotel, walking away in the direction of cities and insuperable traffic problems, and pot and speed and LSD and wildcat strikes, and all the other urban hassles, And if for a little while I felt a muddy nostalgia for all those things, there was nothing positive. Simply a wish to get away from noble savages. Soon the afternoon became sedative. The loch was calm and gray and blue. On the other side, the dark mountains rose, softened with thick brown heather. The sun shone without warmth. A blackbird suddenly exploded in alarm. Then there was silence. The road curved away from the loch, so I left it and went over a little hill rusty with bracken, over a little burn whose water looked and sounded cold, then a small meadow with ochre-colored grass, before the path plunged into a forest darkness. Pine and fir and larch, some holly, three shriveled trunks that lightning had split and left as naked spikes, and light, a stile, and beyond it the clearing where stood the crumbling cottage of the contented, unbitter widow McPhee. A girl in jeans and a yellow waterproof jacket was trying to look through the tiny, grimy window.
Say anything interesting?
Do you always creep up on people like that?
Only on peeping toms, or whatever you call the female of the species.
I wanted to see Mrs. McPhee.
And you're looking at the right window.
Who are you?
Oh, you wouldn't know me. My name's Gardner.
Are you a friend of Mrs. McPhee?
We've met, yes.
I'm Sally Stewart. My father has the hotel across the loch.
I'm with the opposition, this side of the water.
No opposition, I assure you.
And what did you want with the widow McPhee?
She sometimes helps out when we're busy.
You're busy this time of year?
Oh, we're always busy. We're on the main road north.
Oh, of course, yeah.
There's a presentation on Friday night to Angus McGilvery, the gamekeeper. He's retiring after 50 years.
Well, that's a lot of slaughtered vermin.
Angus wasn't one of the gun-happy ones.
Then I hope he has a happy retirement.
You can come to the party if you like. It'll probably go on till dawn.
And the widow McPhee, for once, will be on the right side of the bar.
Yes and no.
Did you see anything when you looked in the window?
Nothing. Black as pitch in there.
Well, she did tell me at our first and only meeting that she couldn't afford candles and whiskey.
Oh, that's her, all right.
Let's see if my eyes can pierce the gloom better than yours.
Want a bet?
No. Can't see a thing.
She must have gone out.
You think so?
Well, if she'd been in, she'd have heard us talking, and that would have brought her to the door. She's an incurably nosy old lady.
It looks like we're both on a deuce. How'd you get here?
I've got a dinghy down there. 3.5 horsepower, outboard.
Nice.
I'll give you a lift to the hotel, if you like.
No, thank you. I'm getting fat, need the exercise.
I'll come back and see Mrs. McPhee tomorrow.
Why did you shiver?
I don't know. Somebody walking over my grave.
The sun's going.
Yes.
Well, if I'm still around, I might come to your party on Friday.
Oh, please do.
Been nice talking to you.
If you walk up the road behind the cottage for about 50 yards, you'll see a path to the left.
Well, what about it?
It runs through a little patch of wood and then across a field to the main road. Save you climbing the hill again.
So I followed her advice along the rutted road behind the house to the path that suddenly dived into the little wood. And halfway through the wood, I met Mrs. McPhee. And we looked at each other for a long time. Then I moved on, through the rough, stony field, and onto the main road back to the hotel. Sky like a flag, straight lines of peach and blue. And the darkness moving down, and the smell of wood smoke. And Gordon, waiting. Nobody's friend, not even his own.
Have some coffee.
In a moment, I want to see Judy first.
I've told her. She took it very well.
She hadn't much choice.
Up the stairs again and along that weary corridor with its balding carpet. The light, greenish now, and the horrible flush doors with their shiny chromium numbers. She was sitting reading, and her face was pale.
How was it? Out.
Interesting. How have you been?
Isolated.
I understand Inspector Gordon's been talking to you.
He has.
I'm sorry, Judy. You see, I didn't quite know what to do.
Perhaps you did the right thing. It looks as though I'll have to get used to isolation.
Not if I can help it.
Oh, please, Steve.
Judy.
I can't take any more, Steve. First I'm accused of murder. Then you come along and tell me I'm in the clear, and I believe you. Then Gordon turns up and says I'm right back where I started.
Judy,
Can't you see I'm being torn in pieces? I don't know why you did it, Steve. It's one thing being cruel to be kind, but being kind to be cruel...
You're getting a bit ahead of everything. Me, yourself, events. And the ironical thing is that you're not even in the game anymore. There's kindness and kindness. And I don't believe in the sort of kindness Gordon doles out. It's the sort of kindness you give to a horse with a broken leg.
That's unfair.
So it's unfair. What do you expect in a rotten, unfair world?
You're sorrier for me than I am for myself.
And that's an almost classic statement of self-pity. Look, I'm not sorry for you, Judy, because I have no reason to be. At the worst, all you're going to suffer is some minor inconvenience. You may even find it an interesting experience.
I don't understand what you're saying.
And I haven't time to explain. You'll just have to trust me. Meantime, I must make a phone call.
The phone's out of order.
Oh, for heaven's sake, not again.
Well, sometimes it seems almost like an advantage.
What did you say?
It seems almost like an advantage.
Almost like an advantage.
What is it, Steve? Where are you going?
To talk to Gordon. Gordon was in the dining room, ruling supremely over a rickety table with an immaculate tablecloth, a pot of milk and a pot of coffee and two colors of sugar, a three-tiered cake stand, loaded with gentility, cakes, horrible with icing, pink, green, a kind of amber, like edible traffic lights, little triangular sandwiches, like the fins of tiny dwarf sharks. Gordon was staring at the whole assembly with a kind of morbid fascination. For once, he seemed pleased to see me.
Are you ready for coffee now?
No, I don't need it. I'm high on something else. Now tell me, how did the tinker who was murdered get to the island?
Huh? Oh, he had a leaky old boat. It was still there when he was found.
And you checked out all the other boats on the lock?
Every single one of them.
And not one of them had been out that night?
We established that conclusively.
So the killer swam out to the island?
It's the only reasonable assumption. We checked on all the swimmers in the district as well, and they all had alibis, ranging from a drunken stupor to a broken arm.
Yes, now that broken ankle...
Oh, it is undeniably genuine.
Ever hear of a place called Fall River, Massachusetts?
August 4th, 1892.
Well, I'm not hot on exact details like that.
I am. I've read all about Lizzie Borden.
A beautiful summer day in New England. A wealthy father, stepmother, two sisters who hated her. A house partitioned off so that the opposing parties need never see each other. Then, a shambles...
Yeah, Lizzie Borden got away with it.
She did.
And to this day, nobody knows whether she butchered her father and stepmother or not.
Nobody does.
You want to go on with this?
Yes.
Well, there are a lot of mysterious aspects to that case. Now, for instance, the place was a slaughterhouse. But no trace of blood whatsoever was found on any of Lizzie Borden's clothes.
There's a theory about that, too.
Oh, yes. The suggestion is that she stripped off her clothes, committed the murders, had a bath, and then dressed again.
Exactly. Now, let's forget Lizzie Borden. Let's switch to the beautiful Elspeth MacDonald.
What about her?
Well, she saw the devil the night the tinker was killed.
Now, let's stick to the point.
I asked her to describe the devil. She said he was a big black man. And that he was naked.
Well, no.
You see, Gordon, the killing of Willie John McPhee was quite carefully and coldly premeditated.
Yes, but why kill a tinker?
Because he could read and write, and that made him no longer humble.
Huh?
I quote from a conversation I had with his widow. I mean his late widow.
Late?
Yes. I saw her less than an hour ago. She was in a little wood not far from her cottage, hanging by her neck from a tree. The daylight had gone, but she was still there, poised above the earth as though she had taken a grotesque leap and gravity had failed her. In the flashlight, her eyes stood out, like the blueberries she had favored that grew on the island where her husband had died.
old woman. A poor old woman.
Incurably nosy, the girl said.
What girl?
She said her name was Sally Stewart, from the hotel across the lock.
That's right.
It seems Mrs. McPhee did occasional jobs for them.
She did?
Anyway, the girl said she was incurably nosy, and how right she was.
I'm incurably nosy myself.
You've rationalized it into a profession.
How did you come to know Mistress McPhee?
Well, she was part of that fantasy of mine you don't believe in.
Oh, I believe it, no.
You should always trust your instincts, Gordon. You were right all the time. The tinker, Calder, Ketch, and now Mrs. McPhee. All part of the same parcel.
Poor old woman.
She knew too much, and it made her no longer humble.
Courting again?
More or less what she said about her husband.
Look, you take the car and go back to the hotel. If the phone's working, contact Grant.
He may be at the hotel already, arresting
Judy. Well, if he is, send him down here.
Gladly.
All these years in the police force, and I've never come up against a mass killer.
Well, Inspector, you're smack up against one now. And so it was all, as they say, getting itself together. The picture was emerging from its component parts. The jigsaw was taking shape. And it was a pity, just one of those things, that the pieces had to be dead bodies. Who knows, maybe the killer had been reading all these alarming reports about the year 2000 and the population explosion. I got to the hotel just as Detective Sergeant Grant was arriving. I said my piece to him, and he never got out of the car. It went surging off, and I stood for a moment watching its lights swing wildly across the night sky. Everything was very still. The first stars were faintly, timidly appearing. I went inside and sought out Judy. She was still quietly reading.
I just came up to ask you something.
What?
What's so special about that book you're reading?
It's the only one in the hotel.
It's a wonder they don't have it on a chain, like the old Bibles. What's it called?
My Life with the Hottentots.
All the best writers nowadays are Jewish.
Are you trying to cheer me up?
If I was, I'd try to do better than that.
I wish you would.
All right, how about this? You're going home soon.
Sick joke?
Statement of fact.
I don't believe you.
Now, I don't want you to start crying or rush out and get smashed or zonked or whatever, but I thought you should know.
Oh, thank you.
Gordon or Grant will probably make it official just as soon as they can. When they do, you're hearing it for the first time.
What happened?
You'll hear all about it later. In the meantime, the less you know about it, the better. It was 2 hours before Gordon came back. His face was grey and lined, and his clothes and boots were streaked with clay. He had the tired, resigned look of the soldier who has just been through it all and knows that all he has in front of him is to go through it all again and again and again. He slumped down in a chair and stared at me as though I was the incarnation of the world's bad luck.
I dropped the whole thing in Grant's lap.
It's big enough.
You don't like it, do you?
Question doesn't arise. You don't like or dislike computers. They just are. I need some legal advice.
On what?
The law of inheritance.
And I'm no good to you there.
Well, who would be?
Oh, what tack is this you're on now?
Did Captain Bevis's father leave a will?
No, he died intestate.
Who handled his affairs?
Old Jacob Buddy.
A local man?
Yeah.
You know him?
Very well.
I think we should go and see him.
We?
Right now. I drove while Gordon slept, oblivious of the maniac DJ from the car radio, oblivious to the hedges leaping out of the darkness like pop-up toys, oblivious of the trouble I was having with a slipping clutch and a tetchy steering wheel. Oblivious. Jacob Purdy's office was closed by the time we arrived, so we went round to his house. His housekeeper showed us into a drawing room that was Victorian enough to be right back in fashion again.
We sat there on horsehair until finally the door opened and Jacob Purdy walked in. He was elderly, squat and dark, with shrewd eyes and a voice as prim and dry as a biscuit.
Well, well, Inspector, this is an unexpected pleasure. Most unexpected.
As much for me as for you, Mr. Purdy.
What's that you say?
This is Steve Gardner. He wants the benefit of your experience on certain matters.
Huh? Is he asking officially? Huh?
Well, I think you may regard him as doing so, yes.
Very cautious way of putting it, huh, Gordon? Still, ask away, young man.
Mr. Purdy, I'd like to be cautious too, if I may.
You may, sir. You may.
I'm going to put before you what is, as far as you're concerned, a hypothetical case.
Hate hypothetical cases. They only bring hypothetical fees,
Well, this is the case of a wealthy man who has only one relative, a son. The man dies without leaving a will.
No problem there. Under Scottish law, the son takes everything, heritable and movable.
Ah, but tell Gardner what those terms mean.
What do they mean, huh? Well, let's boil it down to essentials, huh? Scottish law divides property into two categories, heritable and movable. Movable property is stuff like money, stocks and shares, jewelry, ornaments, money due from life policies, furniture. In fact, stuff that can be moved.
And heritable?
Land and buildings.
Well, suppose my hypothetical man wanted to disinherit his son.
He couldn't disinherit him completely. The son has a legal right to half the movable property. The father can do what he likes with the heritables.
So if the father was really determined to disinherit the son, he would have to get rid of all his movable property before he died, say by realizing all his movable assets and giving them away.
Yes, yes, I suppose so.
And then make a will, leaving the house to someone else.
Exactly.
What about witnesses to a will?
Well, if the will's a holograph will, that's to say if it's written in the man's handwriting, no witnesses are necessary at all. All that's necessary is that the man's signature be acknowledged. Of course, it's better to have two witnesses, if possible, saves all kinds of trouble. Another point about witnesses. Under English law, witnesses can't benefit from a will they've witnessed. Different up here. A witness in Scotland can benefit. Anything else?
Nothing, Mr. Purdy, except to say thank you.
You're welcome, young man. Very odd. I often wondered why old Billy Bevis became such a philanthropist in his old age. Most untypical, huh? Thought it was conscience. Should have known better,
In the car on the way back, Gordon was very far from oblivious.
So the tinker died because he could read and write.
Fantastic, isn't it?
He was a witness to a will that Bevis suppressed.
And therefore in strong blackmailing position.
Do you think McPhee's wife knew?
She knew who killed him. She was quite content to live as a pensioner of the murderer. Then maybe she applied for an increase.
She couldn't read or write. So that makes the other witness...
Calder.
...willing to connive at the suppression of the will for a price.
He was on familiar ground.
What about Ketch?
Why talk about him? You don't believe he's dead.
Now, that's what I would describe as a rather petulant remark.
And that I would describe as a roundabout admission that you finally do believe me.
So Ketch was yet another witness.
But not to the will.
Oh, man, it's a very strange business.
Strange and pathetic.
The sins of the father visited upon the son.
Were you ever inside the lodge?
Only once.
During last year's investigations?
Yes. A beautiful house. It had a feeling of, I don't know, of reassurance.
I wonder if it always had that. Did you know Bevis's father?
Slightly.
I've seen a portrait of him. Remarkable resemblance physically.
Oh, quite remarkable. Old Billy Bevis was a massive man, too, and... very proud of his physical strength.
Was he well liked locally?
He was detested. Cruel, overbearing, without a drop of kindness, and a brutal, violent temper. Actually, there were several rather nasty stories about him.
Unbalanced, would you say?
That might not be too great an exaggeration. Man, Gardner, it's all there. It's all there. And there's absolutely nothing we can do about it because there isn't one shred of evidence.
So that night, I went out to collect evidence. Along the ankle-breaking path that swung to and fro towards Loch Darrick Lodge. The plow hanging high above. The water, quiet as velvet. The house, a silhouette against the night sky. I walked up to the front door, and a dog barked nervously as I thumped the knocker furiously and kept on knocking until up above me, a window opened.
Who's there?
It's me, Gardner. Steve Gardner from the hotel.
And what do you want?
I want to talk to you, Captain Bevis.
Couldn't it wait till the morning?
It couldn't.
Have you been drinking?
Not a drop.
But damn it, old man, I'm in bed.
Then get out of bed and get down here.
I'll be right down.
Now, sir, what the devil does this mean?
Devil is right. He's a big black man, Elspeth MacDonald says. About your height and build, Bevis, but with no clothes on. Now, why would the devil have no clothes on, Bevis? Baffling, isn't it? At least that's the way I found it. Until I had a talk with Jonathan Ketch. And then, guess what, Captain Bevis? That was me in the secret, too.
You'd better come inside.
In part 5 of The Wolf Far Hence by Edward Boyd, the parts were played as follows. Steve Gardner, Teddy Johnson. Detective Inspector Gordon, Moultrie Kelso. Sally Stewart, Tricia Scott. Judy Clark, Janet Michael. Jacob Purdy, Willie Joss. Captain Siegfried Bevis, Robert Urquhart. The Wolf Far Hence was produced in our Glasgow studios by Eddie Fraser.